Welcome back to the Good Life podcast with me, Sabina Push.
And me, Robert Keeling.
So, Rob, today is a really exciting day, isn't it? We've been looking forward to this particular interview for quite a long time.
Well, we have, because today we're going to be speaking to John Kampfner, because he knows more about Berlin, I think, than most British people I've ever met. So he wrote Why Germans Do It Better, which feels like slightly from a different age if you look at a copy now. But he also wrote a really definitive book about the history of Berlin from both a historical point of view, but kind of an everyday current point of view as well. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited about this.
So without further ado, here's our interview with John Kampfner, an award-winning British author, journalist and broadcaster who's now made his home in Berlin.
Hello, it's nice to see you. How is it in Berlin today?
It's fine. The weather's a bit shit, unlike London. But apart from that, life is good.
Good. Well, thanks very much for your time. We just wanted to start off with your personal history. I'm just really interested in what drew you to Berlin in the first place as a Jewish person, you know, from a family who had to leave Nazi Germany and then came to Britain. And then how did you then discover a love for Germany?
So my family history is a curious one. It's by no means unique. My father was a Jewish refugee from Bratislava, from what is now the capital of Slovakia. He fled at the age of 12 in 1939, even after Hitler had invaded Czechoslovakia, as it was then. I never got to ask him exactly how he did it, but I think he went all the way with his parents through Germany and out again to Belgium, and they eventually found their way to the UK. He then did his national service straight after the war, was sent to Singapore, where as a young military doctor, he met my mother, who was one of the first nurses for the British National Health Service. They met in the military ward. She was a proper working class Plymouth Brethren woman from Chatham. So it was an uncanny mixture. They spent about 20 years there, myself and all my siblings. We were born in Singapore, came back to Britain. So that's that part of the history. And curiously, my wife has exactly the same mix of Jewish father and Protestant mother. Her father came around the road from me in Charlottenburg, and her mother came from Baltimore, and they met at the University of Stanford in the US. So curious set of mixtures. And my Berlin history began, well, I was working as a graduate trainee for the news agency Reuters. I spoke Russian and German. I was sent first to Moscow during the early Gorbachev years, just as a trainee for a year. From there, I moved to Bonn, the old sleepy capital, for 2 years. The newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, which, even though it was conservative and not quite my politics, was still a sensible paper in those days, asked me to join, sent me to Berlin. I insisted that I live in East Berlin. So that was 1988. I had the great fortune to spend 2 years seeing it all happen. And the day after unification, they sent me back to Moscow, where I saw that system collapse as well. So I had very early roots in Germany and Berlin. And if truth be told, I then didn't really pay that much attention until the great British psycho nightmare of Brexit took place, at which point I said, I better keep my language polite. I said, sod it, I'm out of here. I'm moving to Berlin, which is what I did. I was basically commuting for quite a few years from about 2018, including during the pandemic, which was interesting logistically. And for the last recent time, sort of full time here.
John, one thing we've been looking at is trying to contrast Berlin and London. So Berlin and London are, on one sense, totally different cities. London's three times as big. It's very different history, etc. I know Berlin a bit, and I'm always struck how there are bits of Berlin that it would be amazing to kind of transplant into London. And then there's bits of London life as well, which I think Berlin could sometimes do with as well. But I wonder if you have somebody who knows both cities as well, and he wrote about Berlin, of course. Are there particular bits in Charlottenburg, for example, which you really think this is, you know, there's something here that could be learned from in London? This would make London an even better city. Or are they so different that that really means anything?
The first thing to say is that I'm a city person. I think I could live in many, many cities around the world, big cities. I don't think I could live in any small place anywhere. And all cities have got commonalities, particularly in the globalization era, and I think we're still in it, even if others think that we're not. But they also have their particularities and peculiarities. And you could get a whiteboard and do the pros and cons of any place. And a lot of things that determine whether or not you want to live in a place are subjective rather than objective. The kinds of friends you have, the memories you have, the sort of logistics and how it works for you, etc. But I mean, Berlin, there's a continual debate in Berlin, and in my book, In Search of Berlin, it forms the final chapter, which is called The Fear of the Normal. In other words, to what degree has Berlin already lost, or is it losing, or is it in danger of losing its exceptionalism? And by that, we're all referencing its extraordinarily traumatic 20th century history, with the two great dramas of the Nazi era, the defeat in the war, and the bombardment of the city. I mean, anybody who's seen those aerial photographs and films to see how much of the city was destroyed, both by the aerial bombardment, by the Soviet invasion from the east, and the rubble of the post-war era. And then compounded on that, you have division and the wall and the separation of the two cities over 28 years. I mean, it's a fascination always to remind people the wall has now been down longer than it was ever up. It's, you know, it's now 36 years and counting, whereas the wall was only up for 28 years. And yet still, I'm currently living in West Berlin, in Schöneberg, and I've lived in Kreuzberg, but I lived in lots of parts of the city, and I still think of it as East and West. That said, parts of the East, Mitte, the absolute center, the historic center, which fell on the eastern side, and Prenzlauer Berg, the area that used to be very down at heel in the north, that's where all the breweries opened in the late 19th century, and has now become the Notting Hill of Berlin, just sort of full of Americans talking too loudly and people eating avocados and drinking flat whites. They don't really belong to East Berlin, but it is still, in many ways, still a divided city. And to a degree, it's become, quote, normal, unquote. You see quite a lot of people walking around in suits, which you never used to before. They're either politicians or lobbyists. At the same time, it's still a place that produces almost nothing. There's almost no economy here. There's a fairly consistently burgeoning startup scene, which has been going on now for 10, 15 years and doing reasonably well. The Charité Hospital has spawned, and the pandemic increased this, a whole new biomedicine industry in and around Berlin. But still, all the big money, unlike London, unlike Paris, all the big money is elsewhere. The financial markets, as we all know, are in Frankfurt. The auto industry is in Bavaria and Baden-Württemberg in the south. Insurance, advertising is everywhere. And all the sort of German corporates, you know, if you're thinking of Adidas, the sportswear company, is in a tiny little town in the middle of nowhere. That's the strength and weakness of Germany. And most things are two sides of a coin. The regional disparities that you see so clearly in the UK between, on the one hand, London and the southeast versus the rest, notwithstanding money being put into Manchester and elsewhere, it is still huge, whereas Germany is a lot more equalized, which in turn makes the capital city less important. I mean, in London, everything begins and ends, whereas in Germany, that absolutely does not apply to Berlin. The population at 3.5 million is still smaller than the population there was in 1939, which says something.
I mean, I've read your book, I really enjoyed it. And I was struck by that point, actually, John, at the end, about this sort of feeling of being at the end of the rainbow. So if Berlin becomes more normal, is it then in danger of becoming another potentially slightly bland Central European city? Some of the commentary, for example, around the arts cuts, for example, in Berlin recently, which can't have been an easy decision for the Senat or the town hall. It's one more step to Berlin becoming, you know, for people who aren't as interested in the 20th century and all of the terrible events you were talking about, they're kind of in popular memory. People know about these things. But you have to, I always think, look for them a bit more in Berlin, more and more. And then I know people who've been to Berlin from outside Europe, you know, don't have some of the historical baggage or sort of background, really. And they look at Berlin a bit more critically. And then it's whether the cafes are any good, is the coffee good, or is the what's the blend of people like? And that always feels a slightly scarier future for Berlin, because it could become a less exciting, more normal city, which I'm sure some Berliners would have very mixed feelings about. They both like change, but then also Berliners are quite a contrary bunch as well. I wonder if you could say a bit more about the so-called Berlin character, or the Berlin Schnauzer. Is it a cliche, or do Berliners can be quite grumpy at times on an everyday level?
Everything depends on where you start from. The service culture in Berlin, the Schnauzer, the snout, is so all-pervasive. The grumpiness, the casual rudeness is so all-pervasive that you expect absolutely nothing. And so when anybody is polite to you or smiles at you, it's very heartwarming because you just never expect it. And it does annoy me. It's sort of what New York used to be in the 80s, and it doesn't have to be like that. It's lazy. It's a sort of defiant, as I say, it's a sort of New Yorker defiance thing. But I think we've all moved on from that. And cities need to be, in the best sense of the term, competitive and welcoming. And I mean, Berlin as a city and the people I know are incredible. And that's why I'm here. You know, I mean, there's all these wonderful little cliches, and you never know whether they are true or apocryphal, but it doesn't really matter, because even if they are apocryphal, they might as well be true. And it applies to Berlin, doesn't apply to other parts of Germany necessarily. So, you know, you have the man, the Schwabe, the man from Swabia, which is, you know, to all Berliners, if you don't come from Berlin, you come from some sort of spießig, petty-minded little village in southwest Germany. Doesn't matter if you've come from Hamburg or Cologne or something. So you have some out-of-towner who steps on the bus and says to the bus driver, "Guten Morgen." The bus driver just ignores him. And then he says, "I said to you, good morning." He said, "I know, I heard." And so you get that sort of sense of, you know, why be polite when you can be rude? And that is annoying. You have to walk a long way to find a beautiful street in Berlin. And I always compare and contrast it with Vienna, where you have to walk quite a long way to find an ugly street in Vienna. Now, having said all of that, I'm here and I love it. And so you ask yourself why, and I use a line in the introduction of my book, which is the faults of Berlin are many and varied. You can see them everywhere and you experience them all the time. But when you get Berlin, it really seeps into your skin. In other words, it's something intangible. I think there's an intensity of conversation. There's a seriousness, which I really, really like. There's not much small talk ever in social situations. You get straight down to what it is that you want to talk about. And also there's a sense of vitality. In Britain, for all the talk of London being multinational, multicultural, which it is, and representative of the five continents, which to a degree it is, it still feels like an island being in Britain. And here you absolutely feel you're on the front line. You're an hour from Poland, and you feel the Russia-Ukraine war much more intensely. And you also, for historical reasons, feel the awful situation in Gaza and everything to do with Israel and the Middle East. You feel very intensely here. I have had some most extraordinarily ardent, impassioned, angry debates with many Germans who I think have drawn the wrong conclusions. And I'm diverging, but I might as well stay on this, from the Second World War on both the conflicts. You know, first of all, nie wieder, never again, does not apply to no more war. It applies to no more dictatorship. So therefore, the sort of German indulgence, particularly among social democrats towards Putin, was something I just found utterly distasteful and so childish and naive. And I never hold back. I just give 10 barrels to people who do this sort of nonsense. And the same with Israel. The idea that criticism of Netanyahu and the genocide that he is meting out in Gaza somehow should be allied to anti-Semitism, to me, is deeply problematic. And I say to Germans, this is guilt-laden virtue signaling. My family suffered as a result, and just because you're feeling guilty about it, you know, and I don't want any lectures from you on how more supportive I should be towards the far-right Israeli leader, Netanyahu. And you should feel utterly ashamed that you are sending weapons to Israel in the numbers that you are.
Well, just building on the, now talking about politics, in terms of the Berlin and London are interesting cities, because if one can put aside Berlin's historical baggage for a moment, they're of course both also cities which democratically their resilience to far right and populism is feels like it's under attack a little bit at the moment, particularly in the rest of Germany. I wonder if you have any observations around the AfD in Berlin and whether they are likely to gain any sort of foothold. My impression of Berlin is always, it's a little bit comparing it to London, which is significantly more multicultural, etc. But Berlin has also such deep contours based on its terrible experiences in the 20th century. It always feels like a city that wouldn't go under. But I wonder if you've got any thoughts about how the AfD campaign in Berlin and whether they have a different narrative than they do in the likes of Saxony or Thuringen, for example, and whether they have to adapt their messages to appeal to Berliners.
Much of the British coverage of the recent German elections really annoyed me. You came away with two impressions. One was that Germany's economy was so decrepit that everybody was walking around in horse and carts. And secondly, that the AfD was goose-stepping through the Brandenburg Gate. And I would get texts from friends in London saying, "Are you okay?" I was like, "What? I'm absolutely fine, thank you very much. You know, I'm having, you know, the sushi is nice, the music's good, you know, life is good, thank you very much. Oh, but we hear that the AfD is about to take over." To which my standard response, which I feel more strongly now than I did 3 months ago when the elections took place, is it's far more likely that Britain will fall under the far right than Germany. The reform, you know, Brits like to say, "Oh, reform's not so bad." And you can argue the toss, it might be by a few percentage points. I don't know how you measure these things. Less extreme than the AfD. But, you know, Britain is sleepwalking into an alt-right, far-right future, which I say terribly sadly, because I really want Keir Starmer's government to succeed. I was so relieved when he took over from the clowns, but his underperformance has been quite dispiriting to see. And in Germany, Merz has actually started quite well. And he's not my idea of politics, but I respect the way he has begun things. And he, you know, he had a reputation for shooting from the hip. And I think he's restrained himself and acted pretty well in the circumstances of coalition. So, you know, the firewall is still there, just. I don't see, I mean, we've still got till 2028, 2029 for a German election to take place. And as I say, I mean, the danger is ever present. Do I see much AfD in Berlin? I mean, I'm probably not the right person to ask, because they are, you know, I'm sure they are campaigning hard in places like Marzahn and elsewhere, and the figures show that. But in much of the parts of Berlin that I inhabit, you know, if you think it in sort of London terms, sort of zone one, zone two, you know, there's not much AfD there. And of course, you have to go to the other lender of the former GDR and other lender of West Germany to see more of an active AfD presence.
I've always noticed that the British don't really report very much on the far left in Germany, which is actually quite a larger group, isn't it? And it is also interesting why the AfD is so strong in the former East. Are those two connected in any way? I've always been quite curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, Die Linke are a really interesting party, and they were the big surprise package at the last elections, very much Berlin. But again, that comes down to the ethos of Berlin. I mean, I don't understand how Berlin works economically. I mean, during the Cold War, when it was a surrounded island, it was defended militarily by the Allies, and it was propped up economically by the Federal Republic. And many West Germans had barely concealed disdain for Berlin. And there are some historical archives suggesting Konrad Adenauer would have been quite happy to have somehow sort of got rid of it in return for other parts of German lands. In fact, he called it the Asiatic Steppes, which I thought was quite amusing. And so you've got a curious economy here of some rigid bureaucracy, and it's slightly getting better. I mean, internet, which was a disaster here, is getting better. And the new Berlin Senat, which is cutting costs here a lot, but it's also mindful of infrastructure. And you've got to have a city that works in order to attract people, both Germans and foreigners, to the city. But at the same time, rents are increasing fast and people don't earn very much here. I mean, if I think back to sort of 20 years ago, I reckon rents and other general costs were about a third between Berlin and London. Now I would reckon they're somewhere around two thirds, three quarters. They're still lower. Almost everything is still cheaper than being in London, but only a bit. Going out to restaurants, it's only a bit cheaper. You know, if you think of the euro as about 1.2 to the pound, it's probably equivalent, euros and pounds now, in terms of what you spend. And, you know, some rents are incredibly high. I don't understand why there is such an incredible housing shortage, given how big Berlin is in terms of geography and territory and how few people live in it. And just another example of endemic housing problems that you find everywhere, but particularly here. So there's a real sort of anguish over how do people live here and how do people get by. On the question of arts and culture, I mean, absolutely, that is what makes Berlin what it is. They say a third of all tourists come to Berlin for the music scene. I mean, that, you know, is an extraordinary figure. The largest single group of tourists, by the way, are Brits to Berlin, which I heard, which I was fascinated about. So I'm on all the different email newsletters from arts organizations, calling to arms, saying what a terrible thing, 15 to 20% cuts on, you know, many cultural organizations here and culture here, or depending on the structure of a particular organization, tends to be a mix of federal funding and regional or city funding. And it is, those are big cuts, but I also can't resist sometimes a wry smile to say, you know, where have you been the last 20 years? Have you seen the state of the British art scene? We would love to start from your position after 20% cuts, if you don't mind. But that's in a sense the wrong way to look at it, because it is the place from where you begin. And in all things, I think there is a happy medium. I mean, Britain now, you can pay 150 quid for a seat in the West End in the theatre. And pretty much every theatre now bases every production on some Netflix or Hollywood or Instagram or whatever star, who quite often isn't very good. And you pay 150 quid for a seat behind a pillar and you come out just feeling fleeced. In Berlin, it's still a lot cheaper, but you can go to some sort of 8-hour monologue on something to do with Tajik poetry or something with eight people in the theatre. And the theatre thinks that's been massively successful because it's always subsidised. Now, that's obviously a deliberately provocative and I'm sure completely untrue comparison. I just made it up. But in order to make the point that there has never been here much of a sense of arts organisations to a degree having to pay their way. And I think there's a fairly standard formula, and it depends on what type of art form, between a third and a third and a third. You know, a third you get from public subsidy, a third you raise commercially through ticket prices, if you have them, shop if you have one, cafe, restaurant if you have one, and the other third through corporate philanthropy, etc. Now, that doesn't always apply, but there's very little of that here, and that needs to be more here. But at the same time, the state also needs to continue to play an important role.
Well, I guess there are also just some things you can't do anymore. So I was in Berlin very recently and visited Tacheles, first time in a while, which, is, as you'll know, John, is a former department store, which was destroyed in the war and is now been basically regenerated. I remember going there back in the late 90s, and it was extremely exciting, but also incredibly dangerous. It was literally a bombed out department store. It's in the on the Oranienburger Straße. It's on quite a very nice old street near the main synagogue. That's a very sort of evocative bit of Berlin as well. And Tacheles is, you know, kind of walking up bombed out bits of staircases held up by chains, people doing spontaneous art shows in rooms, mainly involving banging bottles. It's the kind of thing which is really exciting and made Berlin completely bonkers. And now I just don't think you could get away with. So Tacheles is now very, very sanitized, and it's a very comfortable experience. You can get a nice coffee there and bite to eat and see a bit of the old staircases. You get a glimpse of it. But I suppose it was inevitable that some of these things would be smartened up and made safer. And I'm sure there are still bits of the former East which were popular with clubbing and that sort of stuff. I don't really claim to have my finger on the pulse on that at all, but which are just buildings which you couldn't have open anymore. I mean, around Leipziger Straße, for example, some very old buildings which have now been also as part of the rebuilding of Potsdamer Platz were knocked down. So I guess the physical fabric has changed a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Berlin being very punk, you know, that when I went as a teenager, I was 15, and went with a school trip, and there was a real edginess to Berlin. Do you think that still exists, or is that fading a bit?
I mean, Tacheles, I think, is just an absolute disgrace what they've done to it. It's somewhere between sort of miniature Canary Wharf and Brent Cross on a bad day. I mean, it's just awful, awful place. And when, like you, think back to Tacheles. Now, of course, nothing can stay forever, can't survive forever on sort of decaying staircases and everything else. But I mean, just like they had such a great opportunity to do something with Potsdamer Platz and they didn't, you know, same with Tacheles. I mean, that said, there are some great new projects all over Berlin. It's just that Tacheles isn't one. I mean, it just depends where you start from. I mean, anybody who did the Berlin clubs of the 90s into the noughties, I mean, a lot of the clubs are still there. Some of them are not. And I don't do clubs, but when the people I know who do say that many of them are exactly as they were and they're thriving and you can have a great scene. And somebody I know well, who pretty much every Saturday, every Sunday is at Berghain, says, and has been doing it for 20 years or so, knows everyone, is getting on a bit. He came up with a really interesting phrase, which is, it was a place where the traumatized gather. In the sense that one of the reasons people go to Berlin is almost to banish demons from elsewhere. And it is true. It is a place that you can find your niche. You can do pretty much whatever you want here. If, you know, if you wanted to spend all your time seeing high-end opera, you can go and do that. If you wanted to find some poetry collective, you can find that too. In that respect, it does leave you alone a lot more than other cities. And the other way I would describe it is, if you look at Paris, you look at London, you look now at New York, it didn't apply in the 80s, you feel there's sort of, the picture has already been painted. It's there, and almost you feel like an imposter. You can't leave your mark in any way. It's all there, and you have to sort of conform to the way the city looks already. Berlin is absolutely not like that. Berlin is absolutely a work in progress. And you feel you can be part of that discussion. Now, where it goes in the next 5, 10, 15 years, the direction is reasonably easy to predict. It's got to begin to sort out, as so many cities need to. It's housing issues. I mean, you've got the same problems now that you see everywhere in London. I mean, not nearly to the degree of London, of properties being bought by wealthy Russians, Chinese, Emiratis, Singaporeans, Americans as part of their investment portfolio. And they're always empty. And, you know, I was struck walking around London during the parts of the severest lockdown, places like Holland Park and Kensington, you barely saw a house that wasn't boarded up because they'd all either legged it to their country mansions or back to their original homelands. And you know, I find that deeply, deeply depressing in a city with so much homelessness and poverty. And you've got that. It's growing in Berlin. So the question for Berlin is, it's basically moving in the same trajectory as everywhere else, but at what speed and how will it be managed? And I would quite appreciate an element of normality. I would quite like the U-Bahn to work sometimes. I would quite like the Verwaltungen to work. I would quite like things to be digitized rather than to receive pretty much every public notification through the post. Can't think of the last time I received anything in the post in Britain. So I would like this place to modernize. I would like it to embrace the modernity and globalization of normal cities of elsewhere whilst retaining its distinctiveness. And I don't think that's beyond the realms of possibility.
Do you think that what you were saying earlier about Berlin still finding itself and still developing and creating itself, is that part of what makes you particularly interested in it as a place to live?
Yeah, and the seriousness of it, the debates, getting out my whiteboard again. The single thing that enrages me and disappoints me about Britain is its insularity. Its reference points are only Anglophone. Post-Brexit, it's returned to calling Europe the continent, including in London, and including people I know. And it just drives me mad. And the single thing that keeps me in Berlin, notwithstanding all the things that you know, drive me mad here, as would drive anyone mad, but also any city in its own way would drive you mad, is the sense here that although London looks on the surface much more multicultural than Berlin, I think the cultural reference points here are much more diverse and multifarious.
I mean, one, just bring this to a sort of conclusion, I suppose, John. I think it's an interesting parlor game to think about what the future of Berlin is, like with every city. And as I think you're alluding to, it's the pace of change that tends to be the real sticking point with cities. Are we going to see in Berlin the sort of real hostility, like we've seen in Barcelona, for example, to over-tourism? And now there's a city where people in Barcelona have just felt they've had enough. I was thinking of your remarks right at the beginning about Prenzlauer Berg, which is a lovely bit of the city, of course, but I can see why that really irritates more hard-boiled Berliners. Whether you can change that quickly. And just on the housing point, we had an earlier podcast where we spoke to a housing expert about just how the housing market is overboiled in a way that's like so familiar with, very similar to other cities. Berlin is highly constrained. It's quite striking when you cross the border into Brandenburg. You don't have the sprawl. You get past the Bacon Belt, as it's called, but you kind of you get suddenly into the countryside, and that's a feeling which you never get in Greater London.
I mean, one of the joys of Berlin is the ease of access out of it. You can be at a lake within 20 minutes, half an hour. You can be walking in Brandenburg, which isn't particularly, and some of the lakes are beautiful. Brandenburg itself, there's not, it's pretty flat as a pancake. You can get very quickly to the countryside. You can't get that quickly to beautiful countryside, but still you can get away cycling, walking, whatever. If you want it, and a lot of digital nomads and people escaping the city during the pandemic moved to the Speckgürtel, to the Bacon Belt. Property prices are increasing there, but are still very low compared to, you couldn't find anywhere within 30, 40 miles of the perimeter of London. Not that anybody really knows what the perimeter of London is anymore. So in that respect, it is much more self-contained. I mean, there's a separate issue around immigration. That's a separate issue. I don't get any sense that foreign tourists here, you're not walking down a street and having water thrown at you sitting in a cafe in Barcelona and that sort of thing. I mean, you look at cities like Barcelona, particularly Venice. I mean, the numbers are just extraordinary. The ratio between residents and tourists, particularly in the summer months, is totally out of control. And Airbnb obviously has got a lot to do with that. And lots of cities are clamping down on Airbnb. Paris certainly has, Berlin certainly has as well, and which is all to the good. But tourism is also a good thing, and not just long weekend tourism for culture, which is huge here, but also people coming for 3 months, 6 months, a year to sort of find themselves. It adds to the texture of a city, and it particularly helps make Berlin what it is. I don't think we're there yet. I mean, what I do find interesting is I'm enjoying the fact that in large parts of Berlin now, whereas 10 years ago, everybody would address you first in English. And it's still the case in Prenzlauer Berg and in parts of Mitte around Torstrasse and all those sorts of artsy places. I like it in old West Berlin, where I am, where you walk into the dry cleaners or the bakers or the whatever, and the conversation is in German. Now, obviously, if you're with somebody who doesn't speak German, they'll do their best to talk to you in English. But the reclaiming of the language, I think, is a good thing. It's about pride in the city and pride in the language. So no, I mean, I think, there's it is still an incredibly attractive place to visit. And, a bit of it is because it's German, a lot of it is because it's Berlin, a lot of it is also because it's international.
Let's ask you one final question, actually, because reading your wonderful book about Berlin, it did make me think, is it a sort of superpower coming into a city like that from outside? Do you know Berlin better than a lot of Berliners, perhaps?
I certainly think when I was researching and writing both Why the Germans Do It Better and In Search of Berlin, I particularly, when I was doing the latter book, I came to the idea during the lockdown, because you couldn't sort of do very much except walk. So I think there's barely a street in the city that I haven't walked down. Must be said, in the last year or so, since doing other things, I feel I've led a much more mainstream life in Berlin. You know, you go to the supermarket, you go see your friends, you go places, you know, you go to the gym, you could be in London to do those sorts of things. But, you know, yeah, I do know the city pretty well. And is it different to others? I mean, every area has its own specificity, but you would say that about London as well. And no, but I mean, and I love still, in spite of goodness knows how many hundreds of, I don't know, thousands of kilometers I walk around the city, I still love it when I go places that I haven't been to before and encounter something that I hadn't spotted before. And it's a city of surprises. That sounds a bit of a cliche, but you never quite know what era is about to hit you. And quite often, if you stumble upon a building or a place, it's historically interesting, not just for one era, but for two or three.
Great. Thank you very much. It's been absolutely delightful to chat to you about Berlin and London. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
Bye, guys.
Take care. Bye.
Thinking about our chat afterwards, we're both struck by how well John has got to know his new home city.
Whereas a lot of Berliners never leave their Kiez or their neighbourhoods, he is, I think, a self-confessed Berlin nerd. So he is very keen to explore every nook and cranny of the city.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, isn't it? I think sometimes it's you get a better view of a place if you come to it from outside. So I think we're probably the same about London, aren't we? That we think we know London, but actually if someone came from Berlin, maybe we should need to find someone who moved here from Berlin and can give that outsider's view of our city as well. It's an interesting idea, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess you're like, the fish doesn't notice the water it's swimming in or something. And I've certainly struck when German friends visit London, the first things they notice, particularly if they're from Berlin, I think, you know, that London's a little bit busier, a little bit buzzier as well. It's bigger, of course. And then some of the things that I love about Berlin, the lakes, the cafes, the slightly more relaxed tempo of life, they just think it's totally normal.
Thanks for listening. And if you like what you're hearing on our podcast, please like, subscribe and share it with other people who might enjoy it too. If you subscribe, it'll pop up on your feed so you won't miss an episode. You can find our podcast on Spotify and all other major platforms. Thanks for listening. Until next time.